The following lecture was delivered at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yitzhak Shachet will now present his lecture, 21st Century Antisemitism, a Novel Response to Age-Old Hatred.
Yishai Ribo is a 34-year-old Sephardic Jewish singer from an observant Jewish family which emigrated from France to Israel. On September the 11th, 2023, he did something that was previously deemed unimaginable. He played in Madison Square Gardens to a sellout audience. It was the first time that an Orthodox Jew performed there, let alone to some 20,000 people. It was beautiful. It was peaceful. It was surreal. Fast forward to February 27, 2024, and he performed once again. Again, it was a sellout crowd, albeit a much smaller crowd. It was taking place at Harvard University, put on by Chabad for the Jewish students. The vibe in the room was electric. The vibe outside the room was toxic. There was police standing at the entrances just to protect those inside. There was chanting, there were placards, there was screaming, there was so much venom being spewed. It's like a tale of two cities, two different eras, two distinct universes. What happened in just barely 6 months? What changed so much in so short a period of time? To say that Israel happened, the war with Gaza happened, is, I suggest to you, too simplistic an answer. What really happened was the exposure of an uncomfortable truth that we have taken for granted for far too long. And the uncomfortable truth is that antisemitism is a light sleeper. The implication is that it's always there, albeit lurking underground, waiting for an excuse, waiting for a reason to be able to resurface. And as irrational a phenomenon as antisemitism is, it has never been eradicated. At best, it was suppressed over a period of time because it wasn't fashionable. And yes, society conditions us to curb our prejudices. But throughout the entire course of history, it has always been existent. It's very much like a dog sleeping with one eye open. And when opportunity lends itself, it rears its ugly head yet again. So let me say this. Maybe we've become too complacent. Maybe we had it so good for so long that we didn't think it would manifest itself yet again. Not to that extent. Perhaps we assumed that if we chanted the mantra never again enough times, then so shall it be. So I'd like to pause here a minute, and I want to briefly reflect in the first instance on the essence of antisemitism, and in the context of one very famous story. Because if we are to look historically, and we were to consider what was the first ever real antisemitic threat against the collective Jewish people, it would be, anyone? Purim, very good. It would be the Purim story. Haman was the first who wanted to initiate a final solution. Anashim, nashim betaf, men, women, and children. He wanted to wipe everybody out. He comes to the king, and he asks for the annihilation of the Jewish people, and he offers the king money to do the job, and the king says, by all means, do it for free. And the Talmud, reflecting on this exchange, states that this conversation can be compared to two people. One who had a mound of dirt in his field, and the other who had a ditch in their field. And the owner of the ditch says to the owner of the mound, or says actually in the first instance to himself, how I wish the owner of the mound would give me his mound so that I can go ahead and fill up my ditch. And the owner of the mound says, how I wish the owner of the ditch would make his ditch available to me so I can get rid of the mound on my field and go ahead and put it in his ditch. And after some time, Continues the Talmud, they encountered one another. And the owner of the ditch says to the owner of the mound, sell me your mound. The owner of the mound replies, please, take it for free if only you would. It's a very unusual parable. More than anything, it begs the question. I mean, the story is pretty clear cut. You read the Megillah on Purim, you know exactly what happened. Why does the Talmud feel the need to have to offer some parable to give you further context in the story? And the answer is that this, already in the times of the Talmud, gets to grips with the root core of anti-Semitism. King Ahasuerus has a mound in his field. What is a mound? It's distinguished by its height. And indeed, as far as he's concerned, the Jewish nation is perceived as a great and a lofty nation. Haman is compared to the one with the ditch in his field. He perceives the Jewish nation as a lowly and degraded and despicable and depraved people. So they're coming from different perspectives. Haman offers money, reflecting on his desire to literally purchase the Jews, as one would to then take sheep to the slaughter, to subject them to a cruel and humiliating demise. Ahasuerus, on the other hand, he has a mound in his field. The Jews, he perceives them as something different, something unique. He appreciates them, and he's therefore concerned somewhat for their honor, so he rejects outright the idea of selling them, charging Haman to proceed instead, but with due respect for their exalted status. And the point is this. There are two types of haters in our world. Two dimensions to anti-Semitism, if you will. There's the ignorant hater, and there is the malevolent hater. And that's been our reality from time immemorial until present day. The ignorant hater doesn't know what Judaism really stands for. For some, it's about world dominance. After all, we talk about Mashiach, we talk about universal salvation, we speak about Noahide universal laws. And historically, this was already interpreted as trying to make the world ours. And for others, Judaism, if not supremacy, is certainly superiority, you know, the chosen people complex. Who do we really think we are? And for others, still, the sum total of Judaism is inextricably linked with Israel, which is why whatever happens over there invariably spills over into the diaspora and spills over here as well. So the ignorant hater finds the Jew an annoyance, a mound, a strange phenomenon, something different to him or herself. There's something about the Jew that makes him feel awkward inside. He can't explain it, it just does. It's a mound in his field. And that sort of hater invariably coexists with the Jew and tolerates the Jew. And it's only when opportunity lends itself, when it becomes fashionable to vent the hatred, when it becomes excusable to boycott, then the same professor who shared your common room or business colleague who worked with you, or neighbor who greeted you, will suddenly rear their ugly side. These are people who, on the one hand, may look upon Jewish people with admiration and with affection, or on the other hand, with hate or repulsion, and usually with a mix between the two. But then there's an altogether different dimension to anti-Semitism. Hitler, Yamach Shemai, didn't just hate us because we were different. To put it in his own words, we must destroy the tyrannical God of the Jews and his life-denying Ten Commandments. Alas, all too often there have been many that were inflamed by this uniqueness of the Jew, this ambassadorship, this light onto the nations. Maimonides wrote a famous letter called the Tamanite Letter, in which he was expressing to the Jews then, who were enduring their own anti-Semitism, about this very point to reassure them that already from the moment Torah was given at Sinai, there was this inbred hatred that spilled over into the nations of the world. Based on the very words of the Talmud itself, the Torah was given at Sinai. Why is it called Sinai? Concludes the Talmud, because it's almost a play on the word sinna, which means hatred. the moment those Ten Commandments were given to us and we were imbued with this ambassadorship to the world, there was this inexplicable, irrational hatred that grew and developed in so many others throughout the world. You know, when Haman initiated his final solution, he persuades the king, who only saw us as a mound, as an annoyance, with the argument, they're different than us. Their laws are different than our laws. He evokes within the king the aforementioned ignorant hatred and agitation. But Haman's own hatred comes from a much deeper place. Think about this. The Megillah tells us how the entire Persian Empire bowed down to him. The only one who didn't was Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew. And we are told, Vayimole Haman, Haman was filled with rage in his heart. It consumed him totally and utterly. The world is your oyster. Everybody is worshiping you. One man doesn't yield, and that becomes your problem? That becomes your whole preoccupation? You're consumed with rage about the one person? And yet, Mordechai's behavior exposes a ditch in Haman's heart and soul. It actually exposes the truth. Haman, I know you're no God. It manifests a feeling of emptiness, which induces a deep-seated hatred in Haman. And then he, like others after him, has a choice. Deal with the effect or eradicate the cause. And so through the course of history, we have been hated on both fronts, whether out of sheer ignorance or because of unadulterated malevolence. Today, of course, let's be clear, let's jump and fast forward to the 21st century. The buzzword is no longer Jew. The post-Holocaust era has shoved that taboo to remain in place alongside other extreme forms of racial slur. So in place of Jew, we have Israel, Zionist, because hating Jews is no longer politically correct. Hating Israel and Israelis is the correct way to hate Jews today. Some will argue, as they do, being critical of Israel is not being anti-Semitic. So let's be very clear. Of course, it's possible to criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic. Guess what? Israelis do it all the time. And for some, whilst you can ultimately separate the two, for the overwhelming majority, the lines have become fundamentally blurred. And the reality speaks for itself. Because when a Jewish rabbi in Italy is stabbed because of what's going on in Israel, and when a Jewish businessman in France is beaten because of what's going on in Israel, and a Jewish professor in UCLA is boycotted because of what's going on in Israel, and a Jewish student in London is cursed on the streets because of what's going on in Israel, then it's no longer got to do with Israel or with Zionism or with so-called occupation, and it has everything to do with Jew and Judaism and anti-Semitism. Mainstream culture is finding cover for the age-old hatred of Jews. They figured it out. So long as the attack is battered and flash-fried in a light coat of anti-Israel sentiment, and as long as you pretend that you're fighting for human rights, then the rise of anti-Semitism becomes socially acceptable. Here's a newsflash. Your anti-Zionist comment is anti-Semitic when used in conjunction with any historical anti-Semitic slurs, like Zionists are smelly, Zionists are money-grubbing, Zionists control the media, or bank monopolizing, and so on and so forth. Your anti-Zionism is definitely anti-Semitic when you equate or you compare Israel with Nazi Germany, because if you liken an expansionist state at whose heart was the industrial extermination of the Jews to the only Jewish state, then you are engaging in anti-Semitic speech. And let me stress this. If you think that random Islamic murder in Paris is terrorism, and random Islamic murder in London is terrorism, but random Islamic murder in Tel Aviv is not, then you are an anti-Semite. Throughout the course of history, we have been told you are not wanted here. Abba Ibn famously said, in the past they said Jews to Palestine. Now they're saying Jews out of Palestine. They don't want us here, they don't want us there. They don't want us anywhere. Some scholars, many historians, including many Jews themselves, choose to view this ongoing obsession with the Jew not as something uniquely connected to Jews or Judaism, but they excuse it as, I don't know, a multitude of isolated events resulting from distinct circumstances. Arabs hate Jews because we are occupiers. Germans hate Jews because they were the scapegoat for a depressed economy. Christians hated Jews because they were capitalists. Europeans in the Middle Ages loathed the Jew because of his financial success. The hard fact is that anti-Semitism has existed too long and in too many disparate cultures to tolerate a claim that in each instance it's because of some distinct factor somewhat disconnected from being Jewish. To put it in the words of the book, Why the Jews, economic depressions do not account for gas chambers. Jews have been hated because they were rich, and Jews have been hated because they were poor. Jews have been hated because they were capitalists, and Jews have been hated because they were communists, because they believed in tradition, and because they were rootless cosmopolitans, because they kept to themselves, and because they penetrated everywhere. You see, anti-Semitism is not a belief. There's never a question of how do you get to the roots of it. If you can get to the roots of it, you cut out the roots, you eradicate it. But it's an irrational hatred. It's a virus. The human body has an immensely sophisticated immune system which develops defenses against viruses. It penetrated because viruses mutate. Anti-Semitism mutates, and that's what we are bearing witness to today. And the point I want to get to is this. We can't bury our heads in the sand and assume that this too shall pass. I mean, I'm sure, yes, please God, when things calm down speedily in Israel and they finish the job the way that they need to, things will calm down everywhere else as well. But if there is one thing, and I've said this previously at an earlier session, that these past few months have shown us, is that those who hate us far more than we imagined. And no matter how calm things might become, we cannot afford to become complacent anymore. To the flip side, and I mentioned this previously as well, and this has to be said, I was walking in the West End of London some 3 weeks after October the 7th, and a big, burly, muscly, tattooed guy carrying a coffee in both hands suddenly calls out to me, "Excuse me." And I'm thinking, okay, here we go. I stop, I say yes. And he says, "It's terrible what's going on out there, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." And he adds, "I'm really sorry about it all." And I was like, whoa. I was pleasantly stunned. And I thanked him. And I told him I appreciated his support. And it occurred to me immediately that we have a lot of friends out there as well. And indeed, those who like us a lot more than we realize as well. In fact, I genuinely believe they represent the majority. The problem is they're very much a silent majority. Which means, after all said and done, it's down to us to confront this problem. And there's only one real way to do this. And this has to be said loud and clear, try as we may, we're always going to be limited in our capacity to weaken the enemy. The only alternative is to strengthen ourselves. And the way we strengthen ourselves is by enhancing our own identity. Some argue, and I dare say this is quite commonplace in Europe, that we're better at keeping off a low profile. It's become the acceptable norm. I don't buy it. I maintain that if we revert to what the author Israel Zengel once described as the ghetto stoop, walking with our heads down, keeping below the radar, we're nurturing the germ. We're scoring an own goal. I mean, if the whole point and purpose of anti-Semitism is to reduce the Jewish people into oblivion, then surely when we're trying to keep a low profile and not look too Jewish, we're accommodating the process. Kind of reminds me of a rabbi, a colleague of mine in Manchester, who's struggling to get a minyan. So he's standing outside the shul on a cold, wintry day. And he's there in his tallis and his tefillin, and it's flowing in the wind, and he's stopping one person after another, I need a tenth man, somebody has to say, Kaddish. No, everyone's just casting him this weird and cursory glance and walking on. One guy stops. What's the matter with you? Standing outside like this, with that on? Aren't you ashamed? Aren't you embarrassed of yourself? And he said, ah, you're just the one I'm looking for. Please come inside for the tenth man. You know, I had to go for some extensive surgery back in November 2023. And on the day of my pre-ops, I was very blasé. You know, I was being very uncharacteristic. I wasn't even walking the way I might normally dress. I was just walking with a sweater on after leaving the doctor's office, and my shirt is out, my tzitzis are just flowing away over there, and it just, I kind of looked like a real schluch, as they say, but a real Jewish schluch. It was the day in which, or the day after, that hospital bombing in Gaza took place, and the world was typically quick to condemn Israel before realizing it wasn't even us. And I had left my appointment, and I'm suddenly realizing that as I'm walking back to the subway station, I'm walking past Westminster University. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so class is out, and everybody is coming out. And now that university is by and large frequented by all walks of the Middle East, not Jews. It's known for making lots of anti-Israel Jewish noise. And there I am, reality suddenly dawning upon me, and I'm getting stares. And I admit, my initial instinct was turn around, walk a different route, but then no, I didn't. I actually raised my head a little higher, walked with a little more swag to get those tzitzis really swaying over there in their face, and you know what? Not a dicky bird. Nobody said a thing. In 441 BCE, the Babylonian emperor Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem and ultimately destroyed our first temple, as we commemorated just a few weeks ago, last week. He identified three great young men, known as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he brought them to his land. And he was full of admiration for their brilliance. And under his instruction, they were going to receive a royal education for 3 years, learning the ropes of the palace so that later they will each be able to take and occupy high positions in the court to help Nebuchadnezzar and assist him in ruling his massive empire. And yes, they rose to great prominence. But their biggest challenge was yet to come, because Nebuchadnezzar's narcissism knew no limits whatsoever. And he wanted everybody to worship him. So in the valley of Dura, in the capital city of Babylon, he set up a huge golden statue made from the very gold that was robbed from Jerusalem, from the temple. And his instruction was a simple one. All Jews are going to be assembled in the valley, including, of course, his three Jewish protégés. Music would start up, and then everyone would bow down. And anyone who didn't was going to be cast into a fiery furnace. And the music played, and the whole mass of people threw themselves to the ground as per the royal decree. That is, everyone except for Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the king was outraged. I just spent all this time training you, nurturing you. This is how you repay me. He instructed that the fires be turned up, the furnaces be stoked, and they be thrown in to be burnt. And to cut a detailed story quite short, they were thrown into the furnace and they emerged unscathed. A miracle happened. We actually make reference to this miracle in numerous prayers. Whenever it's a fast day, we make reference, Mish, and also on Yom Kippur. You'll see the words this year and you'll know now context. Mish ano l'chananya mishol v'azarya b'soich kifshon ha'esh, he who answered, Chananya, Mishol, and Azariah in that fiery furnace, Hu Ya'anenu, he, God, should answer us and respond to us as well. Indeed, after they came out from the fire, the rest of the non-Jews, the way the Talmud describes it, kind of smacked the Jews on their faces, on their heads. It's like, what's wrong with you people? You all bow down? Look at your God. Look what he does for you. Shame on you. Sometimes it has to come from the outside to give us a reality check. But then the Talmud elaborates quite curiously on this story and focuses our attention on a seemingly trivial detail. The verse says, then these men were bound in their cloaks, their trousers, pants to you, and their robes and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Says the Talmud, the verse is deliberately emphasizing what they were dressed in before they were cast into the furnace. Their royal aristocratic garb, reserved for nobility. Why, ponders the Talmud, is that detail in any way relevant? Who cares what they were wearing before being cast into the fire? What's relevant is the fact they were thrown into the fire and they emerged unscathed. But the answer the Talmud offers is astounding, it's relevant, and no more time more so than in our present time. And just to appreciate the Talmud's explanation, let me share with you a story that happened some 2,400 years after that one. Rabbi Shimon Schwab was a 21st century leading rabbi in Germany. And he was giving a sermon to his congregation, in which he was elaborating on the sin of the story of the golden calf, and he explained that the calf, the golden calf in and of itself, wasn't really meant as an idol per se for the Jews, that they were abandoning God and choosing to bow down to an idol instead. But rather, the real problem was that the golden calf was to function as something of an intermediary between the Jewish people and the Almighty. We know the story. They had Moshe and Moses until that point. They assumed Moses wasn't coming back after he went up to heaven to get the Torah. So they wanted to create something else, another, a new kind of intermediary. And then he added, for emphasis, the mistake was that Jews don't need a medium between them and God. That every single one of us, as per the first of the Ten Commandments, has a direct relationship with God. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, written in the singular. Asher Hatzesicha, who took you, singular, out from the land of Egypt, from the houses of bondage. God is personal to every single one of us. Not just a God who created heaven and earth, but the first of the Ten Commandments is written in the singular in the first person and emphasizing very deliberately that God took us out from Egypt, that he cares about every single one of our plights. And so he emphasized this point and stressed it passionately, strongly. The word in German for intermediary is Mittler. Mittel means middle, a go-between. Speaking in German, Rabbi Schwab said something to the effect of, Jiden darfen nicht kein Mittler. Jews don't need a go-between them and God. An informer sitting in the synagogue went to report to the Gestapo that in his sermon, Rabbi Schwab stated, Jiden darfen nicht kein Hitler. Jews don't need Yimach Shemai. He deliberately confused the word Mittler with the other. This happened shortly after the Nazis had come to power, January 1933. So the Gestapo summoned the rabbi, and in his defense, he arranged to bring the text of the commentary that he had cited with him to prove the precise words and the emphasis that he was looking to make, which had been, whether deliberately or otherwise, misconstrued. And they said to him, okay, We're going to investigate this, and we'll get back to you. For 2 agonizing months, he had to wait until he was exonerated. And eventually he left Germany and became a prominent rabbi in Washington Heights, in New York, etc. But here's the most compelling part of the story. Rabbi Schwab later wrote that for those 2 months, when he was left in limbo, uncertain if the Gestapo would arrest him, whenever he went to sleep at night, he went to sleep in his clothes. He didn't put on pajamas. Why? And he explained that the Gestapo had a habit of taking accused people from their beds in the middle of the night, executing them, and then for added humiliation, they would then take them and hang them in their pajamas. Rabbi Schwab said he was afraid that the Gestapo would do exactly the same thing to him. They would arrest him in the middle of the night and hang him in his pajamas for the entire city to see. And he reflected. He said, and what would happen the next morning? All the Jews would see their beloved spiritual leader hanging on the gallows in his pajamas. The shame, the disgrace of seeing their rabbi like that, a major source of added humiliation, especially in Germany in that mindset. It would completely demoralize, it would completely erode the Jewish sense of pride or dignity or whatever was left of it even more. It would spell an extra victory for the Nazis, adding insult to injury. And so he slept in his clothes every single night for 2 months. If he was going to have to go, he was going to go out in style with his head held high. Think about this for a moment. A person is facing doom. And what's he concerned about? Jewish pride, Jewish identity, doing all that he can to prevent any further demoralization of his people, of his God, of his faith. Where did Rabbi Schwab get this idea from? From Hananya, from Mishael, from Azariah, who came to their deaths as described in the verse itself, dressed in their finest royal clothes. They were cast into the raging flames, dressed as nobles. In the words of the Talmud, Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah wanted to be cast into the flames in their royal garb so that they would not appear to be vanquished and defeated. They did not want their people to lose their sense of destiny, to lose their inner fortitude. Had they indeed just turned up to be thrown into those fires in otherwise simple garb, they feared that the Jewish people who would witness all this would return feeling, that's it, the Jewish people have been vanquished forever. They refused to give their enemies that extra victory, a feeling that they destroyed not only the Jewish body, but also the Jewish spirit. So they chose very deliberately to dress as noblemen, with their stature erect and their spirits soaring, to ensure that the spark of dignity would shine brightly in the hearts of their brothers and sisters. They may have been bound, they may have been cast into fire, but they would remain spiritually intact and wholesome and serene and full of majesty and nobility and royalty. They would remain princes even in this most depraved and agonizing moment. Their God, their faith, their nation would not be desecrated, so that one day they would be able to reclaim their former glory and majesty. Let's fast forward once again to where we are at today. We're living in different times, thank God. But the same principle applies. To always remember who we are and what we represent to ourselves and to the world. And yes, today more so than at any other time in living memory, the test is strong once more, albeit in different fashion. So we're challenged to ask ourselves, are we ready to fight for our royalty? Are we ready to fight for our divine attire and mission? Throughout the millennia, there have always been those who refuse to surrender their Jewish and divine dignity. We too, today, can and must be proud, inspired, empowered, free, uninhibited, driven to live as Jews, to share Jewish values everywhere, and do what we can to continue to change the world. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, whom you will know, a world-renowned psychiatrist from Pittsburgh, Olav Hasholom, he was always dressed, notwithstanding his immense work and his job with clinics and rehabilitation, addictions, etc., throughout the United States. He was always dressed in real Hasidic garb. Long black coat, long white beard, big black hat, phenomenal individual. Once on a flight, a rather irritated Jew turned to him in Yiddish, "Ashande. Why do you insist in dressing like that in this medieval getup?" He was telling it to him in Yiddish. "You realize how ridiculous you look? Why can't you just dress like everybody else?" And Dr. Twersky turned and responded in perfect English, "Excuse me, is something wrong? You seem agitated. Are you mistaking me for somebody else? I'm Amish?" And the other Jew quickly blushes and he says, "I'm so sorry, I didn't realize you're Amish. I apologize, I mean no offense. I have utmost respect for you and your people, keeping your ways, keeping your traditions." And now it was Rabbi Twersky's turn to respond in Yiddish. "Ah, oy bich volt given Amish, if I was Amish, then you have nothing but utmost respect for me. But since I'm Jewish, you're ashamed of me." Hopefully, one day, you'll have the same respect for your own people as that which you have for others. Friends, we live in a time when we cannot afford to be scared of our own shadows. History has proven time and again that the world respects Jews who respect themselves. In the worst of times, Jews never lost their dignity. For 3,000 years, our ancestors never removed their Jewish clothes, regardless of the threat. We must not lose that same identity and pride, especially now. And even if I'm preaching here to the converted, it's a message you need to take out there to others that you might otherwise know, perhaps fall victim to some of that complex today. Now more so than at any other time in the course of the past 80 years since the Holocaust, we as Jews have to ensure and demonstrate that we will not cower. We have to stand up and be counted and tell the world that Israel is synonymous with Jew. An attack on one is an attack on the other. And that with every odious anti-Semitic demonstration, and with every savage attack, and with every lie fabricated, and with every abuse, we are that much prouder that we belong to a people where our optimism replaces pessimism and our faith exceeds our fears. And I have no doubt, again, that amongst you, there are those that may not always agree with everything Israel does. And again, that's okay. You're no different than many Israelis living in Israel. It's called democracy. But regardless of your views, you cannot deny that as we go around Israel, we see a country that has taken every curse thrown against it and turned it into a blessing. By leading the fight against terror, by becoming world experts in treating PTSD, by bringing disaster relief wherever it is needed. And it is a country that sets an example to the world by developing agriculture to grow food where no food was ever grown before, by developing medicines to help sicknesses that were not healed before, by developing technology to create human possibilities that didn't exist before. That is the reality that is Israel. That is the reality of us, the Jewish people. So let me wrap up with this. We shouldn't, and I have to stress this, we shouldn't allow ourselves to be defined by anti-Semitism. I have to admit, it kind of irritated me that it just continuously came up over and again in one form or another in various different formats over here throughout the retreat, and I understand why. And at one point I was going to say, you know, let's just, it was during the crossfire, and I, thank God, no question came up. I was going to say, you know, enough with the questions about anti-Semitism. We need not be defined by anti-Semitism. It's probably the one word more than any other that came up throughout this retreat. But, you know, if you listen to Verbrengen's, to gatherings of the Rebbe, You'll hardly ever hear that word. They never spoke about love. They never spoke about going out there. They never spoke about Jewish pride. They never spoke about making your necessary difference. We need not allow ourselves to become defined by anti-Semitism. 3,300 years of Jewish continuity, and what? We have to live it ourselves so that we can preserve that little corner in the Guinness Book of World Records as the longest surviving persecuted minority. That's really not the point and purpose of it all. I mentioned at the beginning how the Purim story was the first attempted final solution. And the Talmud famously explains how Haman scored his PR offensive with the king. He concocted his own myths without context. They're lazy. They don't work on the weekends. They don't work on so many Jewish festivals. They won't eat our food. They won't marry our women, etc., etc. But later Queen Esther, as we read in the Megillah, the heroine of the Purim story, steps up to counter, and in her plea to the king, she discloses her Jewish identity, stating simply, "Ki nimkarnu ani v'ami." These are my people, and we are at risk. She tugs at his heartstrings, and she averts the decree. And the Rebbe asks the following question: but what about all those initial complaints that Haman brought? Everything he highlighted about our different laws, about our different behavior, about our different mindset. It's all true. It swayed the king in the first instance to allow Haman to go and annihilate the Jews. Esther doesn't seem to address any of that. What changes in the king's mind? And the Rebbe points out, but she does address it. She says, "Ani v'ami, these are my people. This is my identity. This is who I am." Ahasuerus loved Esther's grace and her nobility. He loved her essence. He loved her soul. She says to the king, "You love me. You love my essence. Do you know what my essence is? I am a Jew. These are my people. Yes, our laws are different. Is that a bad thing? It's what defines me. Yes, we have days when we don't work. Is that a bad thing? It's one of the things that makes me me and what you love about me." And the point is, getting back to how we started, to the ignorant hater, of which there are plenty, yes, you can get into the nitty-gritty of the debate, but it'll only make a difference to those who care enough to want to listen. But the ultimate retort to the irrational hatred out there is ani v'ami. With the ever-increasing threat of anti-Semitism rearing its ugly head, with Israel living under a barrage of constant terror, in the face of all of this, we have a very real choice to make. What can we do to let those powerful words, ani v'ami, resonate? And again, I will stress, if I'm preaching to you, the converted, you all share in the moral obligation of going out there and impressing that principle upon others that you might know, might otherwise hide and shy a little bit away. I was in Florida here a few months ago to speak at the JLI Leadership Summit, which was an amazing event on the very theme of anti-Semitism. And there were philanthropists, and there were campus leaders, and there were U.S. ambassadors, etc. And what I found perhaps most fascinating during the various sessions of the summit, whether in personal conversation or indeed in the various amazing presentations, is the distinction, the very blatant distinction, between the more optimistic and the less optimistic. I heard both sides, and I respect where both sides are coming from, and I think that reflects the reality of many. Some are more, others are less optimistic in the current climate, but I will say this. Moshe Dayan once said, and you remember, he had an eye patch. He said, "For all that's worth seeing in this wretched world, one eye is enough." Judaism says, open your eyes and appreciate that the world we truly desire can be one. It exists, it is real, it is possible, it is yours. And let me throw this in for good measure. My dear mother, may she be well, was one of the hidden children in Holland in the Holocaust. And one story of many that I grew up with was how the Protestant minister who took her in for 2.5 years at risk to his own life, trekked for 3 days in the stealth of a cold winter night, just to know where my grandparents were in hiding themselves in some loft, some attic in somebody's home, to meet up with them where they were in hiding. And he came with a simple message. I need you to know that each night before your daughter, Yati, that is my mother, goes to sleep, I remind her that she is Jewish, and I have her say the first line of the Shema. There are a lot of hidden children out there. Some have always been hiding. Maybe some have gone into hiding since October the 7th. But if a Protestant minister can risk his life to remind a Jewish girl of her identity, we need to all figure out how we're going to go about doing the same. We need to instill a realization within ourselves and in others, a confidence to reconnect to the Shema, to our core Jewish identity. We, the Jewish people, from time immemorial, face our problems and respond to them positively, refusing to give in to panic, bitterness, or self-pity. For 2,000 years, we, the Jewish people, are a collective affirmation of life. Our continued existence and our achievements are a living testimony to one of Judaism's greatest messages to humankind, and that is the principal defeat of tragedy by the power of hope. So let us inculcate ourselves, and indeed others, with the understanding that as Jews, we are not afraid to be different. That it is better to be a hero walking alone in one direction than with a crowd going in the wrong direction. And let's change the narrative. As much as we hear out there, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, we're going to start chanting, from the earth to the sky, thank God for JLI. They might tragically kill our brothers and our sisters in Israel. They might pitifully attack us on the streets of London or the campuses of Los Angeles. And we shed a tear, and we cry, and we lament, but they will never, ever break our spirit, not then and not now. We have to do all we can to reinforce the message, a message of pride, a message of dignity, a message that declares loud and clear that Am Yisrael Chai, we the Jewish people have, are, and will live on forevermore. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.